boyfriend, so we had rarely socialized. We'd made some poor choices, but eventually we both ditched our partners. A year later, we found ourselves snogging outside the Cherbourg Yacht Club after a boozy day, celebrating a win after a rough offshore race. You might expect sailing to be a supremely healthy hobby, but this is far from the whole truth. Sure, we got exercise and fresh air, but we were also consuming copious quantities of chocolate bars and quick carbs during the races, then downing serious amounts of rum and coke in the evenings. The good was very much outweighed by the bad. Our crew mantra was, "Eating is cheating." Leaving the bar to eat a proper meal was frowned upon. It now makes me wince to even think about that. Clearly, there were more than a few significant errors in my lifestyle choices. Looking back to my days as a physiotherapy student when I believe the cancer may have begun, I can see that my diet was terrible. A good meal involved a pile of mashed potatoes, melted cheese and bacon. Green vegetables? What green vegetables? Idiot. Now that I had terminal cancer, the fear of death that haunted my every breath could be shaken off briefly in the heat of the action. But then, with regular and hideous force, the reality of my diagnosis came back and smacked me full in the face. It was as if the Grim Reaper were standing right behind me all the time, an ever-present specter breathing down my neck, waiting for the right moment to strike. When the team started to plan sailing events for the next season, my first thought was, will I still be here then? It made me immensely sad to think about the future, a future in which the world would go on as before, without me. I now took my diet seriously. Gone were the so-called energy snacks and the sugar-fueled drinks. The crew got used to my bringing odd snacks on board and never questioned my low-carb choices. Sailing was more to me than just a frivolous bit of fun. I could forego all those sugary foods easily. All I craved was just a little return to my old life, and if that meant a complete change of diet and knocking back a handful of supplements, that would be a small price to pay. So there I was, on that bright April day in 2000, less than a year after my diagnosis of a secondary and terminal cancer. Despite recently finishing chemotherapy, I still had a PICC line in my arm that led all the way up a vein into my chest. I had kept it in place for intravenous vitamin C infusions. It was fully bandaged to avoid being damaged. Even so, this was not the best attire for a race. Wearing my maracas T-shirt under layers of waterproofs, I left the dock with my crewmates and headed out to the start line. The sun was shining and the wind was a steady 15 to 18 knots. Breezy. Perfect. On the first beat, we found ourselves pounding upwind in a close tacking duel with another boat. A quick tack led to a scramble from one side of the boat to the other. During a tacking manoeuvre, the crew has to get across the boat in windy conditions as quickly as possible. This meant ducking my head under the guardrails before rushing across the deck to sit out over the rail on the other side. Squashed together, it was hard to get out from my position. In my hurry, I misjudged the distance and felt the guardrails scrape off my sailing cap. As if in slow motion, my hands reached out to grab it, but it was already swept away by the wind, over the side of the boat, still attached to my wig. "No," I cried, watching in dismay as they floated off together down the Solent. "Bugger," I said, watching my lovely locks disappearing like a drowning rat under the waves. Andrew was looking at me with an expression that implied asking whether we should go back. Well, only for a millisecond. We all wanted to win, and turning back would have been disastrous. It was never an option. "Leave it!" I yelled. Everyone else was staring at me stunned. It was the first time that anyone had seen me bald. The cold wind whipped past my ears. Suddenly I felt vulnerable, exposed. I put my hands to my scalp, trying to cover up its nakedness. I was mortified. A crewmate saw my look of horror, took off his own cap, and gave it to me without a second thought. "Well, get back on the rail! We have a race to win!" he shouted with a grin. How I loved him, and the whole team. They didn't care about my baldness or my illness. They were still going to treat me as me. Indeed, we did have a race to win. This wasn't a jolly on the river with gin and tonics. Moments later, we were all back on the other rail, roaring with laughter. I have been called many things, but Maracas was the nickname that stuck during my many years of racing with the Swage. I rattled with pills as I took them several times a day. It meant lots of complicated planning, and I am first to admit being organized is not my strongest suit. But I managed. Looking back now at that long list of supplements, I can see that it contained several mistakes, doublings up, unnecessary items, and at times even cancer-promoting ones. I had started to fight back, but I had a great deal more to learn. Rough winds and rocky waves were nothing compared with the turbulent journey that lay ahead of me. Chapter 2. A Spot of Bother. I was first struck with cancer in 1994. That makes it sound like a sudden event, but it wasn't. No cancer happens overnight. For years, I had been seeing a consultant for abnormal cervical changes. Cervical cancer is totally preventable and treatable if caught early and given proper attention. I had trusted the gynecologist to do his job, and I had naturally assumed that he was treating me correctly. I had been given a colposcopy a few years earlier, in 1989, when a few mildly abnormal cells had been found. After several return visits to the hospital and years of repeatedly being told that there were no more abnormalities to be seen, I thought my worries were over, and I assumed the problem had been eradicated for good. But I was wrong. A repeat smear performed at my local doctor's surgery had shown the problem had returned, a severe dyskaryosis, a sign that further treatment was warranted. However, the gynecologist at the hospital had told me that my biopsy, within the same 4 weeks, had shown no such abnormalities. Surprised by this contradiction, I wondered who I should trust, the GP's results or the hospital's. My instinct was to trust the hospital, and the specialist, as a biopsy, was surely more reliable than a smear. My GP told me that there were a few cases where abnormal tissue reverts back to normal. "You might be one of the lucky ones," he said. Perhaps I was. He asked if I wanted to be referred to another hospital, but this South London hospital was a main teaching hospital. A relative had trained as a doctor there. Surely it was one of the best. I stayed put, little guessing the fate to which I was consigning myself. Like anyone diagnosed with a potentially serious illness, I was desperate to believe that my body was capable of healing itself. Was it possible that I had reversed the abnormal changes on my own without any surgical intervention? I shudder when I think back to those visits to that South London hospital. It was during my last visit that I became suspicious of the specialist's behaviour and his overly casual, indifferent demeanour. Every time I saw him, he prescribed a progestin tablet for the symptoms of spotting. But I had no idea that this is a synthetic form of progesterone which raised my risk of breast cancer and may have made the cervical cancer worse too. Not only that, it raised my risk of blood clots and cardiovascular disease, so progestin may have poured fuel on the fire. The specialist dished them out like candy. Put simply, he wasn't doing his job correctly, a fact that would be confirmed 4 years later in 1998, when there was a national recall of over 1,000 of his patients. All the women recalled already had moderate or severe abnormalities detected by a standard smear test. They were each sent a letter stating that there were grave concerns about the screening. Women given the all clear were going on to develop cancer. I knew nothing of this at the time, but became increasingly concerned when repeated visits over a year revealed worsening symptoms. On my last visit, I was begging him for a hysteroscopy, an examination of the uterus that might tell me why I was continuing to have spotting. He replied without even looking at me,
"I'm booked up. You'll have to wait until after Christmas for that."
Wow, really? It was only September. I somehow doubted he couldn't fit me in between September and January. This didn't sound right. But I'm losing weight. Believe me, it's most welcome, but it's going from places I've never lost it before. I'm extremely worried. I simply must get this sorted out. It hasn't got any better. Because I had just started seeing Andrew, I had initially convinced myself that it was the first flush of love causing me to shed the pounds. But the pattern of weight loss was different. I never lost weight from my inner thighs. The supermodel thigh gap eluded me, no matter how many inner thigh exercises I performed, and yet this normally stubborn fat was disappearing before my eyes. Without looking up, he went on,
"You really are worrying over nothing. I'm sure we can sort this out with more progestin."
"But it isn't helping," I protested. Was the NHS in such a bad state that I had to wait until next year? What if I did have cancer? I had already had treatment for early cancerous cell changes, and now I had other classic symptoms. Not only the unusual spotting that was getting worse, but the weight loss. Surely this was urgent. He gave me a thin smile devoid of any hint of compassion.
"Extra bleeding between periods is very common, but I will make another outpatient appointment for you in 2 months' time."
2 months' time? For just another chat? This was totally unacceptable.
Years later, following the recall of his patients and an ensuing inquiry, I was to learn that this doctor typically biopsied only 64% of his patients with cervical changes, against a national minimum guideline of 90%. These women had come to his clinic with abnormalities, all needing further investigations to rule out cancer. A review of his colonoscopies also found those to be inadequate. Of the 64% he did biopsy, far too little tissue was excised to make a valid diagnosis. No wonder my problem had returned. The inquiry was to find that as many as 19 women with advanced cancer were misdiagnosed or incorrectly treated, and the rate of cancer in his patients was 34% above the average. I knew nothing of this at the time, but a nasty thought occurred to me. I wondered if there were doctors who allowed cancer to progress on purpose. I blotted it out. Surely not. Weren't all doctors interested in getting patients well? Didn't they take the Hippocratic Oath? But what if a doctor had made a serious mistake when treating a patient, and instead of owning up to it and risking being sued and losing their license, they stuck their head in the sand by persisting with inadequate treatment? Dead patients don't sue. Might there be doctors out there who weren't giving their patients the medical attention they needed, knowing they had a life-limiting disease? I dismissed the thought. I was being ridiculous. But his apparent indifference to my pleas was enough for me to decide to go private. I'd had enough. I knew there was a problem, and he was not taking it seriously enough. My health was at stake. I flew back to Guernsey with these grim thoughts and worries nagging away at me. But I convinced myself he was probably right. I was by nature a worrier, and I was panicking over nothing. The tests at the hospital so far had been clear, hadn't they? But why had he not done any more biopsies? What if he had biopsied the wrong area? Incompetence would be easy for any gynecologist to cover up. Who would ever know? It was his word against the patient's. The courts always took the side of the expert. I busied myself back at work in my clinic and made an appointment with a private gynecologist locally. This problem needed to be sorted, even though the gynecologist at the hospital had suggested it wasn't anything to worry about.
Apart from anything else, I had a new boyfriend.